The year is 1984. Reagan's a fascist. We're all gonna die by the neutron bomb. So why not eat a plate of shrimp? The movie, Repo Man. Hey everybody, welcome to Unspooled. That's right. I am Paul Scheer. Amy Nicholson's not here. I'm a little bit under the weather, and we could not actually get our MASH episode out in time because I'm sick as a dog. So what we decided to do was go into our archives and pull out one of the episodes that we did at the Alamo Drafthouse. Every month we do a show at the Alamo Drafthouse where we pick a film, and then we talk about that film and the scope of a larger discussion. It's really quite fun. We actually have a new one coming up on March 23rd. It's a Monday, so come check it out if you're in LA. But this month, we talked about Repo Man, the Tony Cox cult classic. That's a hard thing to say all at once. And we talked about LA and why we love to see LA destroyed, whether it's in Blade Runner or Demolition Man. What is it that is so, I don't know, destroyable about LA? We brought on an amazing guest who actually has some real world experience in city planning. You might know him as the host of Hollywood Handbook or Flagrant Ones. His name is Hayes Davenport. And we're going to jump into the conversation that we were having about LA and how the city never really became what people ever wanted it to be. So take a listen to this episode where we talk about LA, Repo Man, and a little bit more. Enjoy.
If Hollywood is a place where we're imagining what the future could be through movies, I was really curious about how does Hollywood, the city, imagine like what Los Angeles would be in the future? Like, how do the people who create Los Angeles do it?
Right.
And so I went kind of digging through history, and I found that, you know, every so often, every decade and a half, 2 decades, LA comes up with this big manifesto to say what they want to do. Like this one that was in 1970. It was called The Concept for the General Plan. And what they theorized...
That's a terrible title. That is the title of a manifesto of someone who goes to like a Burger King with a machine gun.
It looks like the plan is an eyebrow invasion.
Well, kind of what they were thinking is, you know, Los Angeles is so big, it's so sprawling. What if we organize Los Angeles like a bunch of tiny cities and really drilled in on the fact that that's kind of what we are? And so they created this idea of what they thought would be urban centers, where in every one of these little circles, you would just get all of your needs met and you'd never have to leave your part of Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. This would have been like in the 40s, I think, right? Something like
that. This was 70, but I think it was like building 70. Maybe off of that idea.
All they needed to really do is just put a Target in a couple areas and you'll be fine. Because once there's a Target, there's no reason to leave.
But even that, as you know, if you live in Hollywood, is not easy. So Hollywood, when they envision LA, they tend to be very scared. Blade Runner is like a great example of this. So in the 80s, in the early 80s, everyone was freaking out about growth, that there were going to be skyscrapers everywhere. In Westwood, if you know like the Westwood corridor, they did like loosen up the building on that like just for a second. And then like the next day there were a bunch of towers. And so people were freaking out that it was like Blade Runner. That like opening shot where it's like huge towers as far as you can see was like Hollywood's nightmare for like people that lived in the hills, basically.
Because it would block their view?
That's them like looking out from their houses on the top of the hills, basically, imagining how bad it could be. Like, over, yes, because it could block their view,
is
essentially.
Do you know about this, like a real thing called like air rights? Like you would buy like... You would have the rights to like essentially your view. Is that something that... that was in a movie called Burlesque. And it was spoken about with such great like authority that I was like, it sounds like it could be a thing. It's like, we need to buy the air rights. And I don't understand how you would buy
that you control space infinitely up, like straight up above your building. Any planes go over there,
well,
like,
I do remember,
it's
like,
open season.
I lived in New York for a while, for a long, long time, and I lived above Roseland. And Roseland, when it was still like a music venue, was great because I had this amazing shot. Like, I could just look from my apartment all the way from 8th Avenue to Broadway because there's nothing blocking it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Roseland closed, everyone freaked out because essentially they built right up and it just blocked you in. Like, so everybody had this amazing view all of a sudden is staring at another concrete building.
Yes, and everyone kind of loses their shit about that stuff, especially in LA. But it was because of, not because of Blade Runner, but Blade Runner reflects this kind of fear that basically made LA in the mid-80s like kind of stop development altogether. So in 1986, there was a law passed called Proposition U that just shut it all down. And that led to this kind of slow growth thing where, like, we didn't get even close to the 2019 that they're showing in Blade Runner. I mean, it took, like, 5 years to get this theater opened. Like, it doesn't – stuff does not happen that fast here. And it sort of led to a position we're in today where – you wonder if we did have a city that looked a little more like Blade Runner, if people who are now homeless could have more affordable places to live, possibly.
A vision of the future more like her. Or like I read today that
yes.
here in downtown, 70% of these giant new condos that are going up are still unoccupied after a year.
But isn't there like a stat, and you probably know it better than I do, like 88% is not for low, like are not, it's not affordable housing. All the new building that is
all the new buildings going up are basically market rate housing. They're not like designated affordable, which in LA means that they're like crazy expensive.
Yeah, so it's like we are building up for potentially either, I mean, if they're unoccupied, for people who can't afford them, and they're just basically staying empty then.
Yes,
which is, I think, you know, what's going on with the, I mean, again, this is me really pulling from a lot of different places. I don't know if any of this is true. But, like, the idea of, like, why WeWork is kind of failing, too, because it was, like, this is, like, just empty real estate. They're like, oh, we'll throw something in here and we'll try to get some money
right.
from this.
So we have no shortage of empty commercial real yeah. estate. There's a Macy's in this project. I mean, if I'm Macy's, I'm freaking out. I just walked through there. There was not really anyone in there at 7:30 p.m.
Well, who's going to Macy's anymore? I mean, you know, it's like, yeah, no one. It's
yeah.
Like, yeah, it's not. Not a thing.
But you're not allowed to build housing in commercial zones.
Got it.
So that's why when you drive down like La Brea or like places like that, there aren't really any apartments. It's just like a bunch of little stores because you're not allowed to put affordable housing or any kind of housing in those places.
I mean, that's interesting that this conversation was happening in the 80s because that was like the second time they updated one of these plans. If this was 1970, then they jumped to this plan that they started in 1985 and like put out in 1988, wow. which is called LA, a City for the Future.
Wow.
This is their LA.
So scary. They're all so nightmarish.
We're farmers. And
yeah.
there's pitchforks. Look where there's a military.
All the farmers are being slaughtered by the blueprints.
I mean, what is the plan here to just start again? Because that's yeah. what it feels
We're
like.
Just wiping everything out. I can't tell like what's supposed to be good and what's bad. Yeah, they were. So this is in the 80s, and it's LA 2000. They're
yeah,
planning
LA
for 2000. Okay, wow. So basically, the city's like real general plan never really changed since the 40s. There's a weird thing where LA, in say like 1960, was zoned to fit 10 million people. Like, if you maxed out every lot, like, how many people could be on each lot, there would be 10 million people in Los Angeles.
Like, and the whole Los Angeles? Like,
Los
stretching.
Angeles City.
Okay, wow.
Yes. And now it is zoned to fit 4 million people, which is the current population of Los Angeles. So we are technically full yeah. because they took a lot of places that could have held apartments and they turned them into single-family housing. I mean, L.A. is, I think, 80% single-family homes, which makes it really hard to fit more people into it. A lot of that stuff in the 80s, which you can see in movies like Blade Runner and a bunch of others from that period, were kind of related to a phobia of Japanese people essentially taking over the city. Like, you can yeah. see that famous shot in Blade Runner of the woman on the big screen.
Yeah.
It's like an Asian woman. There were a bunch of towers going up in downtown at that time that were built by Japanese companies. This was, like, you remember Gung-Ho?
Yeah, Gung-Ho. I mean, like, you're even talking about Die Hard, which is like, you
yes.
know, Nakatomi Plaza. And it's like, well, what does Takagi have to say about, you know, it's like, it's a very...
Built in that same corridor that you were talking about.
Nakatomi Plaza, yeah. I guess, where is that? I mean, that's on the Fox lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's like kind of Miracle
yes,
Miley.
It's right by there.
It's right
yeah,
there, yeah.
Exactly.
It's that whole...
But it's also, I imagine, in the 80s, you're having like this this economic boom, but there's a lot of money coming in. So there is, like, and we're going to be talking about it a little bit later, but like this idea of like this fear of capitalism, because it's like there's so much going on that it seems like LA is oddly stopping it, which is, or is that like kind of what's going on, that there's like they're holding it back?
I guess, but the only people that have really benefited are people that have owned their homes this entire time, right, and watched them, like, whatever, quadruple in value. It's not like anyone, like, people at lower income levels have been squeezed out of the city and county for a long time. LA County shrunk last year. Not a sign of a thriving community.
Right, yeah.
Because, like, people are just kind of seeking affordability elsewhere.
Yeah. I mean, it never occurred to me, but... picturing the people who own those expensive big houses and benefited from it, that seems to be a nice like subset of people who are rich enough in that they make movies and have made their living off making movies saying that tall buildings are bad.
Absolutely. It has also kept a lot of people that like did okay in movies in Los Angeles. You meet a lot of people that are very defensive about like property values and stuff, who like did some movie stuff for a while, like sold a script or whatever, and now are really, really dependent on the value of that home going forward. We also,
I remember I met, when I first came out to LA, I met a TV writer who had never had anything produced but sold a script every year, and he had one of the nicest houses to this day that
dream
I'd ever been in. Yeah,
that's what I'm pursuing all the time.
But it's like there was this time where you could really, you know, you, like where they were, you know, like especially in this business where you could make a lot of money and do very little.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The go-go 90s.
Yeah.
Man, we missed out.
We did.
Will and Grace, they all get Porsches because they got good ratings. Literally, that is true. They gave them all Porsches.
I mean, I wasn't thinking of air rights when I pulled the next slide that is also from LA 2000, but I think it is about air rights now that I look about it.
Oh,
it is about condensed living.
What? That's where we should build up.
Yeah, know? I don't know why they had this picture in there, to be honest.
This is what LA 20, or this is the 2000, this is LA 2000 according to 1980 LA.
It's the dream.
Wow. Why don't they have stores that just sell socks anymore?
I think if you go to Universal City Walk, which is one of the most thriving economies that we have.
That's where we pretend. We had to build a theme park to pretend that we live in a city. Instead of just doing it in the actual city.
My mom currently lives in a fake city, and it's amazing to see, because she lives in one of these malls that is a, like, apartment living now. It's like,
okay,
the Americana, the Glendale Americana. Like,
yeah,
she lives above like a Kiehl's, and she comes downstairs and she's so excited that she never has to leave the property.
Wow.
And she walks around there. There's a Barnes & Noble. She's very excited about that.
Do you do your family dinners at that Cheesecake Factory?
I've eaten at that Cheesecake Factory too many times. And let me tell you something. It's good. I thought I would be a real dick about it and be like, fuck Cheesecake Factory. It's good. It's legitimately good.
But it's weird, right? That's one of the few places in LA where you can like live above a store.
Yeah.
Something that in New York is just such a basic part of life. You just go downstairs and like get whatever you need.
Yeah, it was it's such an interesting thing. And it's funny to see actually what I've been really impressed with, and this is kind of off tangent, but it's like my mom has found a community in the short time that she's been there that I think is a very difficult thing in LA a lot of the times to interact, to see people. Like, you know, everyone kind of is very independent. And you're saying even like with the single family homes, you don't get a chance to, you don't walk down streets, you don't bump into people. And it's, I thought that was really, like, even though at the root of it, it's so commercialism and you're basically just feeding a machine and, you know, you're spending money to just spend it there. There is an upside of it that she's made more friends in like a month.
I would say that's maybe like the best place to age, like in LA. It's not a good city to age in general.
Yeah.
Because even like downtown, like the closest thing we have to New York, I love the Omega Man, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like a great, you recognize so many downtown landmarks. They somehow, not somehow, I mean, they shut down all of downtown because for decades it was just kind of abandoned by, and like, would totally like shut down after like 5 p.m. Even when I first moved here, I feel
that
like
that was the same thing. Yeah, I was like, I was staying at a friend's apartment. It was, and I was living in New York, and I was like, this is incredibly scary.
Yeah.
This feels like Judgment Night, the another Emilio Estevez classic film with a great soundtrack, mashing them up, hip hop and hard rock together. What? Oh man, Judgment
Imagine
Night.
Imagine one song what that would sound like.
They are already planning what the city will look like when we get old. There's two things that are happening right now that I would love to know more about.
Yeah.
Eric Garcetti this year announced the Green New Deal plan.
Yeah.
With LA in the middle. And then they're also, I think, currently still taking feedback for a plan they're going to announce in pretty soon called Our LA 2040.
Yeah. So I'm happy to talk about both of these. The Green New Deal is an interesting one. It is mostly about electric cars. This is a thing I only learned this year. Right. Electric cars, like, it sounds great. We have the worst ozone pollution in the country. Like, you saw last week, the air was, like, basically unbreathable. And it finally rained, and, like, all that went away.
Right.
Half our ozone pollution comes from not exhaust, not, like, tailpipes. It comes from brake pads and tires. Like, oh, wow. when the car brakes,
yeah,
the rubber, like, shoots off. Little particles and like the brake pads do. So electric cars, I for a long time was like, oh, like when those come along, we'll be all good.
Yeah.
But that's not gonna solve the problem.
That's so interesting. I never realized it was tires.
Yeah. It's tires. Yeah, tires and brake pads. Like is a huge, huge part of it. The only way we're gonna get out of it, which this Green New Deal doesn't really cover, is housing and like bus and bike lanes. But you move housing close together,
right,
people don't have to drive 2 hours
to get
to work every day. It improves our air. And bus and bike lanes move so many more people if you put them in the right places than car lanes do. Car lanes move barely anybody and they move so slowly.
Yeah.
And so.
So the plan basically, I mean, that seems like the only way you can kind of modernize a city to a certain extent, too, is like mm-hmm. open up more, you know, access to these things. I mean, but then you also are having, I mean, I don't know if you know much about this, but the idea of these scooters.
Yeah.
I hate these scooters, and I'm like, oh, well, there must be a thing.
You're talking to the wrong guy.
You love these scooters?
I'm known as the Scooty Cutie.
What?
I'm scooting all over town.
Are you wearing a helmet?
Yes, I am wearing a helmet.
Okay, so
my wife has told me she will divorce me if I do not wear a helmet. She has put some very embarrassing reflective strips all over it.
But you know what? I think that honestly, that seems to me the safe way to do it because I had a friend who recently was on one of those scooters,
yeah,
and she got really messed up, but not terribly messed up. She just happened to flip over when there were no cars to run her over.
Flip over?
Yeah, like because she was on like a weird, you know, lime, and it kind of jolted forward. And,
yeah, some of them are weird.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's the storage when you see somebody just come by and fucking chuck them like you're throwing garbage into a wastebasket. Maybe the wheels aren't going to stay aligned.
I have wiped out twice.
Okay.
I did hit my head so hard one of the times. The helmet saved my life.
Yeah.
I had been drinking. and it seems like, oh, this is, I mean, better than driving.
Right.
You have to admit, it's better than drinking and
sure,
driving.
Sure, of course.
It's only really myself that I'm mortally endangering by doing this. But, yeah, I mean, the scooters, we think of them as pedestrians. So this is what LA makes us do. They sell us this idea of, like, scarce resources, right? They make us fight over scraps. We get this tiny little bit of sidewalk space for pedestrians, for scooters, like for cyclists, and then right next to you is 8 lanes for cars that are like untouchable. And so to me it's about like we should make like scooters should be a part of our like climate future. The place I'm working right now is like 2.5 miles away. Great scooter distance.
Right. That's perfect. That's
faster than driving.
And if you maybe if people had their own scooters, they can protect themselves adequately.
Yeah,
because she said that my friend said that the doctor at the hospital was like, "We have had such an unprecedented amount of head injuries and severe trauma due to these scooters." No one's really releasing those numbers.
Some did come out. I think for other cities, not for LA. It's a lot of head injuries because people don't wear helmets.
Yeah.
So helmets, if people did wear helmets, that would take out a lot of the
problems. That seems like that. Yeah.
No deaths except for one scooter rider who was murdered by someone who targeted them, a truck driver who like chased them down.
So
and
very much like so a whatever you're
targeted
them,
drive, yeah.
You're not, you won't get away with it.
Did he know him or was he just mad he was on a scooter?
I think he got like cut off or something and like flipped out. But was immediately arrested for murder.
Yeah. I mean, on that note of road rage, maybe this is a good segue to talking about Repo Man.
Yes, I love
which is
it.
A movie that you like and that I've never, I never had seen Repo Man before today, and I've heard so much about this movie. And it's, I mean, how many of you have seen Repo Man before? Was this your first time? All right. All right, so I asked a weird question.
It sounded like just one clap, but actually a lot of people silently raised their hands.
Yeah. It's a really interesting movie that I think, you know, especially spoke to a time. It's so bizarre, and it's one of those interesting movies that I think borders on, like, is this really terrible or kind of, like, really amazing? Because it feels, and I hate this term, but I'll use it because I have a limited vocabulary, it is very punk rock. I mean, it has like that thing of like, we just fucking made a movie, you know? And I feel
it's a universal movie. That's the craziest thing about it. You see that title card and you're like, it's very hard to imagine Universal, the studio that brought you Fast and Furious, making something like Repo Man.
Well, you got Iggy Pop to do the opening? All right, we're in.
Well, we're going to talk about all that and how it was made, but I feel like we should play the trailer just to get into like the proper Repo Man headspace.
What you got in the trunk?
You don't want to look in there.
Suppose you're thinking about a plate of shrimp. Suddenly somebody will say like plate or shrimp or plate of shrimp out of the blue. No explanation. No point in looking for one either. It's all part of a cosmic unconsciousness.
You eat a lot of acid, Miller, back in the hippie days?
Sell that car and send me your money. You don't need that car.
Put it on a plate, son. We'll enjoy it more.
Couldn't enjoy it anymore, Mom. This is swell.
What's this?
Charming friends you got there, Otto.
Thanks. I made it myself.
I had a lobotomy in the end.
Lobotomy? Isn't that for loonies?
Not at all. A friend of mine had one.
I do my best thinking on the bus. That's how come I don't drive, see? You don't even know how to drive.
I don't want to know how. I don't want to learn, see? The more you drive, the less intelligent you are.
Wow, that was a trail. Like again, like 1984. I'm impressed with Universal that even got that far.
I mean, they made a movie that is so weird, and I'll just talk over this. They made a movie that is so weird that the credits even play in reverse in the opposite order of the way that credits play, because everything about this movie is just insane. But it's the story of the Chevy Malibu with something mysterious in the truck. There's a couple competing groups of repo men who are chasing after it, also some federal agents. They're running around Los Angeles, and it's made by this man named Alex Cox, who was a British filmmaker. He was incredibly smart. He came to Los Angeles from England on a Fulbright scholarship, and he used it to study film when he was 23 years old. And he was kind of broke and kind of punk rock and kind of disreputable. Like he says it at the time, he was living in Venice Beach behind a sausage-making factory, and that his roommates at the time were just a bunch of weirdos. That he
I feel
had.
Like this story is not true because that seems like a commercial plant, and that seems like he's living in, he's mixing commercial and home real estate.
In Venice.
Okay, fair enough.
Maybe, yeah. Like back then, maybe you could put a sausage factory
in Venice. Maybe it was not legal sausage factory.
That's what made Venice so cool.
I live by the sausage factory. Yeah. Hang 10 and then get 10 dogs.
There were a bunch of, yeah, like punk people out there. Like Raymond Pettibon lived really? Out there from, like, in, well, yeah, a lot of. It's not a very punk place right now, but yeah, back then it was.
It will be after a giant tsunami ruins all the real estate. But so, like, he knew a bunch of weirdos. One of them was a real repo man, and he would go riding with him, and that's where he got a lot of ideas for the film that he put into the script. He also lived with a guy who was an actual glass and window installer who told him a story about John Wayne that made it into the movie, pardon the 80s language, but here it is.
Repo man don't go running to the man, Marlene. Repo man goes it alone.
It's a rebob.
Just like John Wayne.
Damn right, just like John Wayne. What's wrong with that?
Greatest American that ever lived.
John Wayne was a fag.
What did you say, Melissa? What?
John Wayne was a fag.
The hell he was!
He was too, you boys. I installed two-way mirrors in his pad in Brentwood. And he come to the door in a dress.
Ah, you're fucking nuts. Oh, that doesn't mean he was a homo, Miller. A lot of straight guys like to watch their buddies fuck. No, I do.
Yeah.
Don't you?
I have to say, I kind of admire how progressive his buddies are at the end. I actually went trolling the internet to see if I could verify this story one way or another, because there are a lot of gossip stories about, did John Wayne like to dress in women's clothes? Based, maybe inspired by this movie he did called The Spoilers, where he was wearing a beautiful feather boa. There's a guy who wrote this book called John Wayne, Duke or Duchess. And it's a man who says that he would cross-dress with John Wayne, that they had a lot of fun cross-dressing together. His story is that...
Myron Stiegelberg. Prominent L.A. cross-dresser and accountant to the stars.
You know. But he says that John Wayne took up the habit from John Ford, who had the habit, and that John Ford had the habit of dressing in women's clothes, that he had picked that up from Winston Churchill. So there was this, like, long line of famous men who would dress up together. And Myron Stiegelberg swears that John Wayne was actually buried in a wig. Jeez. In, like, a fancy long wig. He has this photo for proof. It's very blurry, even on the internet. So I don't know if it's true. I can't vouch for it. But he says the guy with the great legs is John Wayne. And that's Myron Stiegelberg, the shorter one, to the side.
Wow.
Well, this is interesting because I know, and, like, whenever you're writing stuff, it has to be vetted through a lot of different things. So when we did the Black Monday pilot, you know, one of the main characters says, like, you can get anything for a price. Don't believe me? Watch Game 7 of the World Series. Keep your eye on Bill Buckner, right? And Showtime's like, no, you can never say that. And we're like, what do you mean? Like, you can't, that's defamation. You can't say, like, and I've gone through that so many times. Yeah. I mean, you must have done
that. Of course. Yeah. It never occurred to me. What would it be like today if you were making a giant studio movie?
Yeah.
And said, like,
John Wayne used to watch his friends fuck and he was a cross-dresser.
But or everybody would be like, okay with it. They'd be like, yeah, that's fine.
But even, like, I mean, this was, like, almost 40 years ago, so it would be someone who had died much more recently.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, I don't understand how, like, legally that is even, like, a possibility. Like, that was the thing that really struck me in that scene, because I was like, you can't say that. You can't say that in a movie. Like, you can't even say, like, McDonald's without having, like, it properly vetted in a certain way, you know? It's like, so I thought that was, like, just an interesting, I don't know if law has changed or
they just felt it was worth the legal exposure.
Repo Man just doesn't believe in law. Repo Man doesn't believe in law. There is no law. So part of what Alex Cox did to get this movie made is he came up with a graphic novel. He didn't actually get that far. He says he only did 4 pages of it because he got bored. But he drew out what Repo Man would be, and he was taking it around to try to use it to sell the film. Here's a panel. I like this one on the next page. Because it has club cocktails in the little corner, which I really enjoyed drinking when I was in college, and he did too. But they do not make it in the film for reasons we'll get into. And one of the people who bit and said, I want to help you get this movie made, was Michael Nesmith from The Monkees.
By the way, 4 panels, Michael Nesmith is like, I'm in. He's like, it's basically saying, like, hey, I got bored with my own idea after 4 panels. Not 4 pages. Not even the first act. 4 panels. He's like, I'm in. I like your moxie. Let me give you some more. Like,
here's millions of dollars. Surely he'll complete an entire movie. He did.
I mean, look, this guy was smart from the Monkees.
He's a weirdo. I pulled a clip of the Monkees just to sort of establish that he was always a big weirdo who would totally love to fund stuff like this.
Don't get too upset. It might not be all that bad.
No, of course not. And all those things you read about, it couldn't be true.
It's okay, Pete. It'll be all right. Don't worry. We'll do something.
Fellas, I'm scared. I don't want to go to hell.
This is just the Monkees going to hell. So Michael Nesmith takes Repo Man and he's like, you wanted to make this for $70,000. I think we can get millions of dollars to make this. He makes some deals at Universal. Universal winds up greenlighting the film, but Universal has this idea that if this is sort of a rock and roll production, they want to make the movie more rock and roll. So there's this character in the film that's played by Harry Dean Stanton, and Universal's like, why don't we get Mick Jagger? We really want Mick Jagger in this movie. And Mick Jagger totally ignored them. But they did get one rock and roll person in the movie but
the funny thing was, is years later, Mick Jagger did finally pair up with Emilio in Free Jack, another post-apocalyptic, fun run about cars and bodies and everything. But I love that Mick Jagger's always like hanging around the acting thing. I wonder if he was he's like, I could do what David Bowie does. Like, I feel like but Mick Jagger in that part would have been terrible.
Not a lot of range on that guy.
Does anybody recognize the actual rock and roll star who's in this picture? Jimmy Buffett.
What?
Jimmy Buffett. It is Jimmy Buffett. Jimmy Buffett is in Repo Man, thus giving it the rock and roll cool cred.
Well,
that it
by
so
the way,
when
you are
needed.
Making a movie about punk rock and you can score a Jimmy Buffett, you know that you're really appealing to that community.
That was and that Mike Nesmith is making it. I don't understand what the Monkees are, I guess, because it seems like the equivalent of that today is like Joey Fatone walks into Warner Brothers and was like, I found this guy who's never made a movie before.
Joey Fatone going, I like this guy Ari Aster. I think we should invest in Midsommar.
And the first frame of Midsommar is Joey Fatone presents.
But it is this movie. I think that they were reaching to get any sort of celebrity in it. Like they even approached Muhammad Ali at one point to be like, "Hey, would you be in it? Like you'll come and you'll try to like touch the car, but the car even rejects you, Muhammad Ali." And he was like, "They said he listened very politely and then declined as politely." So yeah,
is Iggy Pop not in the movie because Iggy Pop
would have been the
cameos.
Best one. Yeah,
like,
he would have
show up for that stuff because he did the song.
Yeah, he did the opening song, which he was inspired by a road trip that he, I guess, like that song is the oral equivalent to a road trip that he took. Like, but it's a great song.
Yeah.
And the soundtrack is really what was the big hit on this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of the story with this is that when it came out, Universal hated the movie and didn't want to release it, but the soundtrack was already out, and kids loved the soundtrack so much that they were almost pressured to put the movie out despite their will.
It's
kind of
funny. It's like the way that we talked about Hard Day's Night. Like, the soundtrack to Hard Day's Night was so successful, but it was just sort of like, yeah, well, here's a soundtrack too. But, you know, like, and that was like the one of the biggest hits of the thing.
Yeah, but so they were desperate to have any sort of cost-cutting measures they could. So they reached out to people for sponsors, and only two people said yes. The car freshener Little Tree sponsor said yes, which meant a lot to Alex Cox because his roommate who had been a repo man said that truly every car he repossessed did have one of these little trees.
But this is a crazy thing. Like, they have money to be like, yep, we'll drop some. It's like Master Lock does one commercial for a year at the Super Bowl, the Master Lock commercial. Like, Lil Tree's like, we're just looking for that great opportunity. Like, bring it. Like, can we go? Can we get some money from Lil Tree's now?
And it's not a great promotion in the movie. I mean, guy just hands him one and says, these are in every car.
And then,
not that they're like, that they even smell good.
Yeah. And he seems to proceed to throw them in the trash. Like, he's like, this is garbage. If you don't want it, it's garbage.
That's harsh. The second people who said that they would donate goods was Ralph's, our local hometown grocery store, Ralph's. Because in the time, in the 80s and 90s, early 90s, they did have these like aisles. Does anybody else remember this? Aisles of just generic products in a grocery store? Because I thought I had been hallucinating it until I started doing the research for Repo Man. That looked like that. We had one in my grocery store in San Antonio. It was an aisle that was just black and white on all sides. And my family, wow, we weren't rich, so we bought a lot of stuff there. And I thought I was making it up because I was such a kid. But this is a commercial for it from Ralph's.
$20 on groceries.
We switched to Ralph's.
Switch and save.
Instead of filling our cart with all name brands, we switched to Ralph's Plain Wrap.
And just like that, Plain Wrap saved us up to $20 a cartful.
And what selection. Most other supermarkets don't even come close.
Even just a couple of smart switches could save us at least a buck a bag.
Buck a bag.
And the quality? Hey, it's from Ralph's.
So switch.
And save at least a buck a bag at Ralph's.
So I got really into this and I started looking at all of the pictures of food that used to exist. Yeah. Like, I found a picture of the potato chips that I know we had. This is the box that the potato chips came in, but I definitely know my dad used to buy these. And then I started looking for the grossest things I could find. I found these hot dog sausages in brine.
That's the factory right behind Alex Cox's house.
No frills. I take one frill.
And then I realized I was finding out that actually in the early 80s, this whole idea, as kind of like a fuck you to capitalism, to Reagan, this idea of generic products became really cool, and that they started to launch a series of what they really called the No Frills book, where they hired writers to write genre books that were just labeled as exactly what they were. Wow. And they started to do a movie. They did a treatment for a movie that was called the No Frills Movie. And it was, wow, I found this website about it, and it was like written by the film critic David Anson, who I know. So I emailed him at 4 a.m. and he was like, how did you find out about this? But it was a whole thing, and it was kind of cool. And one of the people who got really into it and this whole aesthetic was Johnny Rotten, who loved this idea of these products. And you might remember that his band had a video that came out 2 years after Repo Man that opened like this.
Wow.
And then Alex Cox goes on to direct Sid and Nancy.
Yeah. Well, actually, yeah. And this is actually the whole like packaging and cover art on the next slide for like this entire album. Everything on the album looked like this, which I think
that's
is really rad. It's super badass. But yeah, then he goes on right after this to make, then Alex Cox goes and makes Sid and Nancy.
Do you want
to
hear my insane Ralph's fact? I can feel us getting far away from Ralph's.
Normal Ralph's,
I'm worried
fact?
I'm not going to be able to unleash my Ralph's fact that crushes at parties.
Oh, wait, I want to hear this.
Ralph's is named that because the guy's name was Ralph's.
Wait, Ralph's?
George Ralph's. That's why there's no apostrophe.
That's amazing.
Do you want to hear? So it's even crazier. I can escalate.
Yeah, please.
Smart and final?
Yeah.
Their names. Yeah, this guy knows.
Final is a name.
Yes, they're both their names.
Wow.
No.
Yes.
No.
I give you this party gift.
Like, if your name is Smart and Final, you do need to get into some sort of, yeah.
What if they had wanted to be Undertakers?
Yeah.
So, Alex Cox wanted to end Repo Man with a nuclear bomb, or really a neutron bomb, that blew up all of Los Angeles. Because the 80s, again, were a time where we were really freaked out about atomic warfare. I did pull one of these like duck and cover commercials from the 50s. It's like out of date, but I just love it, so I wanted to play a little bit of it.
Duck and cover.
Be sure and remember what Bert the Turtle just did, friends, because every one of us must remember to do the same thing. That's what this film is all about. Duck and cover. Paul and Patty know this. No matter where they go or what they do, they always try to remember what to do if the atom bomb explodes right then. It's a bomb. Duck and cover. Sundays, holidays, vacation time, we must be ready every day, all the time, to do the right thing if the atomic bomb explodes. Duck and cover. That's the first thing to do. Duck and cover. First, you duck. Then, you cover. You duck and cover tight. Duck and cover under the table. It's a bomb. Duck and cover.
He did what we all must learn to do.
You
and you
and you
and you.
Duck and cover.
I'm
obsessed with this idea of duck and cover because it seems to me like such a line of bullshit, like that clearly this is never going to protect anything.
Mm-hmm.
But they're like, we do need to answer it. So that it sounds good. But like, I feel like the people back then must have been like, but this is this is not going to work, right? Because it's an atomic bomb, right? Like we understood what the power of the atomic bomb was. Like, that's not... It wasn't like if you were down low, you would avoid... Yeah. It wasn't like a...
We're falling for the same thing right now. They tell us in an earthquake, get under a table or something.
Yeah, that always seems wrong to me.
There's thousands of miles of gas lines running underneath this city. If there's a big earthquake, we're all blowing up.
What about the
table will not save you.
What about the triangle rule? I heard that was like the new hip thing. Is the triangle rule?
I don't know about the triangle rule.
It's like you don't get under the table, or I wouldn't get under this chair. If I could get under the chair, I'd get right next to it so that if the ceiling fell, it would fall on me, but then it would leave a little pocket right here because it wouldn't fall straight down. So it'd be a little tent and I'd be more safe.
What's wrong with getting under the table?
Well, I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Anyway.
The triangle rule. And where's the triangle in this scenario?
You are the triangle.
Oh, I'm the triangle. Okay. Yeah.
I've also heard about... that there are sinkholes like in those fields that would just turn to sand
That's mostly by the beach.
Okay,
because it's closer to the ocean.
Okay,
that's liquefaction. Yes. Immediate. You're getting sucked into the earth. That's ideal. That's the best case scenario for you.
Oh, no.
Just get absorbed from whence we all came.
So part of why the bomb was on Alex Cox's head was because Reagan had just okayed making 800 new bombs. And these are neutron bombs, which are the bombs they talk about in the film. And what a neutron bomb is they called it, like, the capitalist bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Because the whole idea was that if, like, the bomb that hit Hiroshima, which is not a neutron bomb, hit Hiroshima, it would level everything. You know, it leveled all the buildings. It burned everything on the ground, including the people. But what a neutron bomb would do was it would hit a city and it would just only destroy the people. And it would leave the towns fine so that Mad Max could, like, move into Los Angeles after it had been, like, bombed. But the city itself would stay okay. So there's a scene here where we talk about the neutron bomb in Repo Man.
Ever been to Utah?
Sir, I represent the Helping Hand Acceptance Corporation.
Radiation. Yes, indeed. You hear the most outrageous lies about it. Half-baked gogglebox do-gooders telling everybody it's bad for you. Pernicious nonsense. Everybody could stand 100 chest x-rays a year. They ought to have to. When they canceled the project, it almost did me in. One day my mind was literally burst. The next day, nothing swept away. I'll show them. I had a lobotomy in the end.
Lobotomy? Isn't that for loonies?
Not at all. A friend of mine had one. Designer of the neutron bomb. You ever hear of the neutron bomb? Destroys people, leaves buildings standing, fits in a suitcase, so small, no one knows it's there till blammo. Eyes melt, skin explodes, everybody dead. It's so immoral working on a thing can drive you mad. That's what happened to this friend of mine. So he had a lobotomy. Now he's well again.
So the actual inventor of the neutron bomb did not have a lobotomy. He was alive when this movie came out. His name is Sam Cohen. He had a lot of interesting, kind of crazy ideas. One of them, which he put on a cover story the exact month that Repo Man came out, was that the way to solve the Mideast peace crisis was to line all of Israel with a radioactive wall so that nobody would want to get in.
Wow.
That didn't happen. He wrestled a lot with his, like, atomic ideas later in life. He self-published this book. Fuck you, Mr. President, Confessions of the Father of the Neutron Bomb.
He seems very sad about saying fuck you. He seems remorseful.
I take no joy in saying this, Mr. President.
That's the one thing that's kind of great about this movie, and I feel like something I haven't really seen is, like, just unadulterated anger. Like, you know, I think that a lot of times you see movies that, like, have a point of view that are saying something, and by saying something cleverly, but very rarely do you see, like, anger. Just, like, it's not really focused. I don't know. Like, it's like they're just mad at society. And I think there's something really interesting about that. In a weird way, I feel like it's a great time for this kind of a movie to come. I could see this movie coming back in a way. Like, I know there was sequel opportunities.
Well, yeah, Alex Cox has been trying to make a sequel. He had this idea in the 90s that he would make a film called Waldo's Hawaiian Holiday. Because, you know, Repo Man ends with Emilio Estevez getting taken away by aliens. This would be 10 years later, he comes back to Earth.
From Mars, where he's been well-treated.
Exactly, and he has to wrestle with this, with fitting in into like the 90s when he's an 80s punk rock guy. And this movie never got made because like Emilio Estevez and Alex Cox just blamed each other. They both said that the other one didn't have enough juice in Hollywood to get it made. And
right,
so they just
said
walked
that
away.
Basically, it was about ready to get made. And then Alex Cox is like, well, everyone knows Emilio's film career is kind of shit, so they wouldn't do it. And then Emilio's like, I said I wouldn't do it because the script made no sense. And he goes, and Alex Cox is just mad at me because I don't go to like the DVD director commentaries and the fan, you know, the fan signings because I live my life like I'm driving a car. I don't look in the rearview mirror, which is an odd thing because I do think a good driver is, yeah, you're doing both.
Not all the time.
Not all the time. Yeah, you shouldn't drive by looking through the rearview mirror, but you should use it. I would say at least 25% of the time while driving.
This is why you hate scooters.
There's no rearview mirror. Yeah.
But it's, you know, I was actually thinking about Emilio Estevez and like what he did because he's like a clean cut kid. And when you think about like this role is a more of a Charlie Sheen role than it is an Emilio role. And Emilio did like all these kind of weird movies. This Maximum Overdrive, the Stephen King fueled cocaine fantasy about, you know, power tools coming to life. He made weird choices, but he said that this movie actually connected him to his brother because he knew nothing of the punk rock scene. He was a very kind of nerdy kid. And he's like, I'm going to go hang out at punk rock clubs and like understand the culture. But I do think it's interesting that like he is the face of this movie because he seems like he has none of that edge. It almost seems like he's like, this is funny, right? This is cool. Like, I'm a bad guy. Like, I know there's something like very sweet about him in this movie. Like, it seems like he's acting. Yeah.
I wonder if he researched. I mean, it was like a legit scene, the LA punk scene at that time. It seems weird that it would be like born out of here. But have you seen like Decline of Western Civilization?
Yeah, I love
that
movie.
Oh my God. The greatest. So funny. But yeah, it's weird to think of him entering that world to like study this or something.
I got a little insane and I started trolling Getty Images for pictures of Emilio. It wasn't Charlie Sheen who was into punk rock. It was the other brother that nobody thinks of whose name I already just forgot.
Okay,
I'm so sorry. I did find one picture of that brother like at a red carpet with their dad, and his brother did have like neon platinum kind of hair, which I didn't pull up actually because then I thought nobody cares about this. So I'm crazy. But I guess I could tweet it.
I would like to see Martin Sheen. Okay. Yeah.
All right. But Alex Cox also had a hard time trying to make a sequel because he didn't have the rights. Universal owned the rights to Repo Man.
And they were building that part of the theme park. It was going to be like Simpsons Land, Repo Man Land.
But in the 90s, he made this ultra low budget, or the 2000s, he made this ultra low budget film called Repo Chick.
With Jacqueline Genet?
I pulled the trailer because it's awful. The entire movie, 95% of it is shot on a green screen.
Oh, boy.
That you were disinherited. Did they offer up any sort of deal?
They told me to get a job.
Oh boy.
You guys are repo men. Man, I saw a movie about you.
Dixie,
there's your first assignment. You see a big old trailer at the end of the street? You need to liberate that.
You have 30 seconds to vacate this property. 10, 9.
The problem, she's no good. Since yesterday, she has ripped 5 cars, 3 planes, 6 shopping malls, and 2 places of worship.
3 antique railroad cars, $1 million reward?
Forget it, Pinky. That antique railroad car is an urban myth to encourage typical no-hoper jerk-offs like you.
I saw the entire train, 3 cars and a locomotive. August, assign me that train. I found the train.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard. Since you have declined to join our righteous cause, I will be obliged to detain you.
Dixie, if you fail,
mortgage defaults will continue to rise, forcing more repossessions. Bailouts will cease to save us. Bankers will stop making loans, zero credit, a worldwide recession, and thus the end of the repo trade.
It's like Legally Blonde.
The feeling that you might just be created by a mad scientist as part of a tabletop experiment.
Yeah. Whoa. So Universal is not cool with this movie. They're like, how dare you make Repo Chick? So they decided that
I think their fear was not founded in seeing any footage.
So they decided to get revenge. They had the rights to a novel that was called The Repossession Mambo. And they had already started to make a film about the Repossession Mambo, which is about people stealing organs. And then they just decided to retitle it. It was the movie that they had on the shelf starring Jude Law and Forest Whitaker. They just named it Repo Men and had it come out right after Repo Chick as a giant fuck you.
But you say it as like come out after Repo Chick. I can't imagine that Repo Chick didn't. The only way that Repo Chick came out was like Alex Cox knocked on your door with a DVD player and said, can I play this? When is it convenient for you?
But the good news, if people want a new Repo Man, is that the deal he had with Universal that gave Universal the rights to the Repo Man characters was for 35 years. And if anybody wants to do the math, on 1984 to 2019.
Wow, it's exactly 35 years.
He has been making vague noises that he might bring Repo Man back.
So this is a chance for him to bring, I mean, well, not with Harry Dean Stanton, obviously, R.I.P., But not with Emilio, I guess. So yeah. What is like, I mean, but I do think that, you know, going back to this idea, this is a great time to do it. Like, cause in a weird way, you know, everything that you're railing against in the '80s and Reaganomics, there's now, it's kind of this other side of it now. And I think it would be actually in good hands. This concept could be really well executed.
Yeah, are they Alex Cox's hands?
Yeah, no.
I mean, it's a sad thing because the reason it might not be able to succeed today is because they did that. So it became a cliche because it was cool in the 80s.
And right.
That, like, anti-consumerist, like fuck the man, like, vibe is considered a little bit corny and, like,
try hard now. I feel that way. That's how I feel right now.
I know, but if you like saw a movie, like a new movie that was like McDonald's,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Don't
you know where you're eating?
Yeah, it's just kind of been done,
yeah,
in a way because of movies like this that were so groundbreaking at the time. You know, it's like the curse of being very influential is you kind of can't do it again without being corny.
Yeah, and it feels like, based on just simply Repo Chick, it doesn't seem like that hand is deft or even really seemingly capturing anything that was of the first film.
Yeah.
It seemed like the thing that he gravitated towards was the repossession part of it. Like,
you always see in those movies, like, somehow, like, John Larroquette or, like, Tara Reid just, like, shows up. And you're like, what are they doing in this movie? But nobody, he got
nobody.
No one, not even Jimmy Buffett.
What? Jimmy Buffett couldn't even fly his little plane overhead just to get a wave. I am... You know, I wonder about this. Like, we're talking about this idea, like, what is good left as your legacy? And it's this weird thing where, do you dilute the thing that you made by revisiting it and, like, cashing in on it? And I think this one would be, yeah, I think, well, he already tried to.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if this is, like, I don't know who finances it. But right. If he gets it back, I don't know.
If he repossesses it?
If he repossesses it.
I think the right move is actually to tease it just a little bit every year. To, like,
right.
Instagram the cover page of Clerks 3 and be like, here it is. It's coming.
Jay and Silent Bob. And that movie also didn't come out in the theater, but just came out at local places.
I like that. He's putting on a show.
It's
vintage.
It's a road show.
Touring with the movie.
I don't think it's a bad thing. I'm just saying it's catering to your crowd.
Yeah.
Instead of, like, saying it's for everybody, it's not for everybody. It's for the people who really want to see it.
And then it's like being Jimmy Buffett.
Yes.
You're Jimmy Buffett traveling around. I guess you have people come to you for margaritas.
That's right. And your fans will give you all the money that they have. And,
right.
And you don't need to, like, expand beyond that.
Yeah, I guess maybe that's the way to do it. Maybe that is the most punk rock thing that he could possibly do. He's a genius. We figured it out. He's a genius. All right, people, that's it. Thank you for listening to this episode. Like I said, we do these shows monthly at the Alamo Drafthouse. The next one is Monday, March 23rd at 7:30 p.m. Buy your tickets if you have not. And then next week, we will get back on our regular schedule for MASH. Robert Altman's MASH. Oh, my gosh. And I cannot wait for you to hear a clip that I picked. It is so, so good. All right, we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.